sickness, that Brother Langrian was quite young, perhaps not yet 20 years of age.
"Do not tire yourself too much," Binnabig added, "but tell us what you know."
Langrian closed his eyes again, as if falling back into sleep, but he was only marshalling his strength.
"There were a dozen or so men who came in sheltering from off the road."
He licked his lips. Binnabig brought the water bag.
"Many large parties are travelling these days. We gave them to eat, and Brother Skenisepha put them up in Traveller's Hall."
As he drank water and talked, the monks seemed to slowly gain strength.
"They were a strange lot. Didn't come down to the main hall that night, except the leader, a pale-eyed man who bore an evil-looking helm and dark armor. He asked if we had heard word of a party of Rimmersmen coming north, from Urchester."
"Rimmersmen?" said Hengfisk, frowning. "Urchester," thought Simon, racking his brain. "Who could it be?"
"Abbot Quinkinnes told the man we had heard of no such party, and he seemed satisfied. The abbot seemed troubled, but of course he did not share his worry with we younger brothers. The next morning, one of the brothers came in from the hill fields to report a company of riders from the south. The stranger seemed very interested, saying that it was the rest of their original party come to meet them. Their pale-eyed leader took his men out to the great courtyard to greet the new arrivals, or so we thought. Just as the new company had crested Vine Hill and been sighted from the abbey, they looked to be only a head or two fewer than our current guests."
Here, Langrian had to stop for a moment's rest, panting slightly. Binnabig would have given him something to make him sleep, but the injured monk waved away the troll's offer.
"Not much more to tell. One of the other brothers saw one of the guests come running out, late, from Traveller's Hall. He had not finished donning his cloak. They were all cloaked, though the morning was warm, and beneath it there was the flash of a sword blade. The brother ran to the abbot, who had feared something of the like. Quinkinnes went to confront the leader. Meanwhile, we could see the men riding down the hill, Rimmersmen all, bearded and braided. The abbot told the leader he and his men must put up, that St. Hodirun's would not be the site of some bandit's struggle. The leader pulled his sword out and put it to Quinkinney's throat."
"Merciful Aidan," breathed Hengfisk.
"A moment later we heard hoofbeats. Brother Skenisepha suddenly ran to the courtyard gate and shouted a warning to the approaching strangers. One of the guests put an arrow in his back, and the leader slit the abbot's throat."
Hengfisk stifled a sob and made the sign of the tree over his heart, but Langrian's face was solemn, emotionless. He continued his narrative without pausing.
"Then there was carnage, the strangers leaping onto the brothers with knife and sword, or pulling bows and arrows from places of hiding. When the new arrivals came through the gate, it was with their own swords drawn. I suppose they heard Skenisepha's warning, and saw him shot down in the gateway arch. I do not know what happened then, for all was madness. Someone threw a torch upon the chapel roof, and it caught a fire. I ran for water, as people screamed and horses screamed, and something hit me on the head. That is all."
"So you do not know who was in either of these two warring bands?"
Binnabig asked.
"Did they fight with each other, or were they being partners?"
Langrian nodded seriously.
"They fought. The ambushes, had a much more difficult time with them than they did with unarmed monks. That is all I can say. All I know.
May they burn, hissed Brother Hengfisk.
They shall, Langrian sighed. I think I must sleep again.
He closed his eyes, but his breathing did not change. Binnebik straightened up.
I think I will be walking a short ways, he said.
Simon nodded.
Ninit Kantaka, he called,
and the wolf leaped up, stretched, and followed him. He had vanished into the woods within moments, leaving Simon with the three monks, two living, one dead. The services for Dokkais were brief and spare. Hengfisk had found a winding sheet in the ruins of the abbey. They wrapped it around Dokkai's thin body and lowered him into a hole the three able-bodied folk had dug in the abbey's cemetery, while Langrian slept in the forest with Kantaka for a guardian. The digging had been hard work. The fire in the great barn had burned the wooden handles from the shovels, leaving only the blades to be wielded by hand, straining, sweaty work. By the time Brother Hengfisk had completed his impassioned prayers, coupling them with promises of divine justice, seeming to forget in his fervor that Dokkais had been far away from the abbey when the murderers had done their work, it was the darkling tag end of afternoon. The sun had dropped until there was nothing left but a bright residue along the crest of Vine Hill, and the grass of the churchyard was dark and cool. Binnebik and Simon left Hengfisk crouching at the graveside, goggle eyes tightly shut in prayer, and went to forage and explore around the abbey lands. Although the troll was careful to avoid as much as possible of the scene of the tragedy, its results were so widespread that Simon quickly began to wish he had returned to the forest camp to wait with Langrian and Kantaka. A second hot day had done nothing to improve the condition of the bodies. In their bloated, swollen pinkness, Simon saw an unpleasant similarity to the roast pig that crowned the Lady Day table at home. A part of him was scornful of his weak-heartedness. Hadn't he already seen violent death, a battlefield full in a few short weeks? But he realized as he walked, trying to keep his eyes ahead, to avoid the sight of other eyes, glazed and cracked by the sun, that death, at least for him, was never the same, no matter how veteran an observer he had become. Each one of these ruined sacks of bone and sweetbreads had been a life once, a beating heart, a voice that complained or laughed or sang. Someday this will happen to me, he thought as they threaded their way around the side of the chapel. And who will remember me? He could find no ready answer, and the sight of the tiny field of grave markers, their tidiness cruelly lampooned by the sprawled bodies of slain monks, offered him little comfort. Binnebik had found the charred remnants of the chapel's side door, areas of sound wood showing through the coal-black surface like streaks of new-cleaned brass on an old lamp. The troll poked at the door, knocking loose burned fragments, but the structure held. He gave it a more vigorous poke with his stick, but still it stuck closed. A sentry who had died on watch.
Good, Binnebik said. It is suggesting we may wander inside without the whole structure crashing upon our heads.
He took his stick and poked it in through a fissure between door and frame, then used it like a mason's pry bar, pushing and levering, until, with a little help from Simon, it sprang open in a shower of black dust. After working so hard to open a door, it was truly strange to enter and find the roof gone, the chapel as open to the air as an unlidded cask. Simon looked up to see the sky framed above him, going red at the bottom and grey at the top with the onset of evening. Around the top of the walls, the windows were blackened in their frames, the leading twisted outward, spilling its sooty glass as though a giant hand had pulled off the roof. Reached down through the beams and poked out each window with a titan finger. A quick survey turned up nothing of use. The chapel, perhaps because of its rich draperies and hangings, had burned to the walls. Crumbled ash sculptures of benches and stairs, and an altar stood in place. and the stone altar steps bore the ghost of a floral wreath. A perfect, impossibly delicate crown of paper-thin leaves and diaphanous grey ash flowers. Next, Simon and Binnebik made their way across the commons to the residences, a long, low hall of tiny cells. The damage here was moderate. One end had caught fire, but for some reason had burned out before the conflagration had spread.
"Be looking especially for boots," Binnebik said. "It is sandals these abbey men wear mostly, but some of them may occasionally need to ride or travel in cold weather. Some that are fitting you are best, but in necessity settle for too large rather than too small."
They started at opposite ends of the long hall. None of the doors were locked, but they were distressingly bare little rooms, a tree on the wall the only decoration in most. One monk had hung a flowering rowan branch above his hard pallet. Its jauntiness in such spare surroundings cheered Simon immensely, until he remembered the fate of the room's resident. On the sixth or seventh, Simon was startled when his pulling open the cell door was followed by a hissing noise and a blur of something whisking past his ankle. At first he thought an arrow had been shot at him, but one look at the tiny empty cell showed the impossibility of such a thing. A moment later, he realized what it was and quirked his mouth in a half smile. One of the monks, no doubt in direct contravention of abbey rules, had kept a pet, a cat no less, just like the little grey scattercat he had befriended at the Hayholt. After 2 days locked in the cell, waiting for the master who would not return, it was hungry, angry, and frightened. He went back down the hall looking for it, but the animal was gone. Binnebik heard him clomping about.
"Is all well, Simon?" he called, out of sight in one of the other cells.
"Yes," Simon yelled back. The light in the tiny windows above his head was quite grey now. He wondered if he should head back to the door, finding Binnebik on the way, or go back and look some more. He was interested at least in examining the cell of the monk with the contraband cat. A few moments later, Simon was reminded about the problems of keeping animals shut in too long. Holding his nose, he looked quickly around the cell and spotted a book, small but nicely bound in leather. He tiptoed across the suspect floor, hooked it off the low bed, and stilted out again. He had just sat down in the next cell to have a look at his prize when Binnebik appeared in the doorway.
"I am having small luck here. You?" the troll asked.
"No boots."
"Well, it is fast becoming evening. I think I should be having a look around the Traveler's Hall, where the murderous strangers were sleeping, in case there is some object there that will tell us anything. Wait for me here,
Simon nodded, and Binnebik left. The book was, as Simon had expected, a book of Aden, although it was a very expensive and finely made book for a poor monk to have in his possession. Simon guessed it was a gift from a rich relative. The volume itself was unremarkable, although the illuminations were very nice, at least as far as Simon could tell in the fading light. But there was one thing that caught his attention. On the first page, where people often wrote their names, or words of salutation if the book was a gift, there was a phrase, carefully but shakily written.
"Piercing my heart, there is a golden dagger. That is God. Piercing God's heart, there is a golden needle. That is me."
As Simon sat looking at the words, his newfound resolve was tested. He felt a wave wash through him, a staggering ocean breaker of remorse and fear, and a feeling of things that, though unseen, were nonetheless slipping heartbreakingly away. In the midst of his staring reverie, Binnebik popped his head through the door and tossed a pair of boots onto the floor beside him with a muffled clatter. Simon did not look up.
"Many interesting things there are at Traveller's Hall. Your new boots, not least. But dark is coming, and I may take only a moment more. Meet with me before this hall, soon."
And he was gone again. After long silent moments in the troll's wake, Simon set the book down. He had planned to take it, but had changed his mind and tried the boots on his feet. At other moments, he would have been pleased to find how well they fitted, but now he just left his tattered shoes on the floor and walked down the hall toward the front entrance. The muted light of evening had descended. Across the common stood the Traveller's Hall, a twin to the building he had just left. For some reason, the sight of the door across from him swinging listlessly to and fro filled him with vague fear. Where was the troll? Just as he remembered the swinging paddock gate that had been the first signal that all was not well at the Abbey, Simon was startled by a rough hand grasping at his shoulder, pulling him backward. "Binnipeg!" he managed to shout, and then a thick palm was clamped over his mouth, and he was crushed back against a rock-hard body.
"Wow ist du Kunde?"
a voice growled at his ear in the stony accents of Rimmersgaard.
"Im tust den Grucke,"
another voice sneered. In a blind panic, Simon opened his mouth behind the shielding hand and bit. There was a grunt of pain, and for a moment his mouth was free.
"Help me! Binnipeg!"
he screeched. Then the hand covered him again, crushingly painful now, and a second later he felt a black impact behind his ear. He could still hear the echoes of his cry dissipating as the world turned to water before his eyes. The door of Traveller's Hall swung, and Binnipeg did not come. Chapter 21. Cold Comforts. Duke Iskrimnor of Elritzhala had put a little too much pressure on the blade. The knife leaped from the wood and nicked his thumb, freeing a sudden stripe of blood just below the knuckle. He fumed a curse, dropped the piece of heartwood to the ground, and stuck his thumb in his mouth.
"Freke is right," he thought. "Damn him. I'll never have the knack of this. I don't even know why I try."
He did know, though. He had convinced old Freke to show him the rudiments of carving during his virtual imprisonment at the Hayholt. Anything, he had reasoned, was preferable to pacing about the castle's halls and battlements like a chained bear. The old soldier, who had served the Duke's father, Ispeon, as well, had patiently shown Iskrimnor how to choose the wood, how to spy out the natural spirit that lurked inside, and how to release it chip by chip from the prisoning grain. Watching Freke at work, his eyes nearly shut, his scarred lip quirked in an unconscious smile, the demons and fish and lively beasts that climbed into being from beneath his knife had seemed the inevitable solutions to the questions the world put forth, questions of randomness and confusion, in the shape of a tree limb, the position of a rock, the vagaries of rain clouds. Sucking on his wounded thumb, the Duke toyed in disordered way with such thoughts. For all Freke's claims, Iskrimnor found it damnably hard to think about anything at all while he was carving. The knife and wood seemed at odds, in pitched battle that might elude his vigilance at any moment to slide over into tragedy.
"Like now," he thought, sucking and tasting blood.
Iskrimnor sheathed his knife and stood up. All around him, his men were hard at work, cleaning a brace of rabbits, tending the fire, getting camp ready for the evening. He moved toward the blaze, turned, and stood with his broad backside to the flames. His earlier thought of rainstorms came back to him as he looked up at the rapidly graying sky.
"So here it is May a month," he mused, "and here we are, less than 20 leagues north of Urchester. And where did that storm come from?"
At the time, some 3 hours gone, Iskrimnor and his band had been in hot pursuit of the brigands who had waylaid them at the Abbey. The Duke still had no idea who the men had been. Some of them had been countrymen, but none had familiar faces, or why they had done what they had. Their leader had worn a helmet in the form of a snarling hound's face, but Iskrimnor had never heard of such an emblem. He might not have even survived to wonder, but for the black-robed monk who had screamed a warning from the St. Hoderan's gateway just before toppling with an arrow between his shoulder blades. The fighting had been fierce, but the monk's death, God's mercy to him, whoever he was, had served notice, and the Duke's men had been ready for the attack. They had lost only young Hover on the initial charge. Einskaldir had been wounded, but killed his man anyway, and another beside. The enemy had not been looking for a fair fight, Isgrimnor thought sourly. Faced by Isgrimnor and his guard, fighting men all and itching for action after months in the castle, the would-be ambushers had fled across the abbey commons to the stables, where their horses were apparently saddled and waiting. The Duke and his men, after a quick inspection, found none of the monks alive to explain what had occurred, had resaddled and followed. It might have been more politic to stay and bury Hover and the Hodirundans, but Isgrimnor's blood had been fired. He wanted to know who, and he wanted to know why. It was not to be, however. The brigands had gotten a start of some 10 minutes on the Rimmer's men, and their horses were fresh. The Duke's men had sighted them once, a moving shadow sweeping down a fine hill onto the plain, heading through the low hills toward the Wealed Helm Road. The sight had filled Isgrimnor's company with new life, and they had spurred their horses down the slope into the valleys of the Wealed Helm foothills. Their mounts seemed to have caught some of their excitement, drawing up reserves of strength. For a brief while it had seemed that they might run the waylayers down, coming on them from behind like a vengeful cloud rolling across the plain. Instead, a strange thing had happened. One moment they had been rolling along in the sunlight, then the world had grown perceptibly darker. When it did not change, when half a mile later the hills around them were still lifeless and grey, Isgrimnor had looked up to see a knot of steel-coloured clouds swirling in the sky overhead, a fist of shadow over the sun. A dim, grumbling crack, and suddenly the sky was spilling rain, a splatter at first, then torrents.
"Where did this come from?"
Einskaldir had shouted across to him, a hissing mist now pulled like a curtain between them. Isgrimnor had no idea, but it had troubled him greatly. He had never seen a storm come up so fast out of a relatively clear sky. When a moment later one of the men's horses had slipped on the wet, matted grass and stumbled, throwing its rider, who, thank Aedhen, landed safely, Isgrimnor raised his voice and bellowed his troops to a halt. So it was that they had elected to make camp, here only a league or so from the Wealed Helm Road. The Duke had briefly considered going back to the abbey, but the men and horses were tired, and the blaze that had been roaring from the main buildings when they rode off suggested there would probably be little to go back for. Wounded Einskaldir, however, who though Isgrimnor knew better sometimes seemed to possess no emotions save a general fierceness, had ridden right back to the abbey for Hover's body, and to pick up anything else that might give a clue to the attackers' identities or motivations. Knowing Einskaldir and his ways, the Duke had given in quickly, stipulating only that he must take Sludig along, who was a slightly less ardent spirit. Sludig was a fine soldier, but nevertheless valued his own skin enough to provide some counterweight to bright-burning Einskaldir.
"So here I stand," Isgrimnor thought, in tired disgust, "baking my bum in front of the campfire, while the young men do the work. Curse age, curse my aching back, curse Elias, curse these damnable times."
He looked down at the dirt, then stooped and took up a piece of wood lying there, which he had hoped some miracle would help him shape into a tree, to lie against his wife Gutrun's breast when he returned to her.
"And curse carving."
He gave it to the flames. He was tossing rabbit bones into the fire, feeling a little better for having eaten, when there came a sudden roll of hoofbeats. Isgrimnor dropped his hands to wipe grease on his kirtle, and his liegemen did the same. It would not do to have a slippery hand on axe or sword. It sounded like a very small company of riders, two or three at most. Still, no one relaxed, until Einskaldir and his white horse came clear against the twilight. Sludig rode just behind, leading a third mount, across whose pommel were draped two bodies. Two bodies, but as Einskaldir explained in his terse manner, only one a corpse.
A boy,
Einskaldir grunted, his dark beard already shining with rabbit fat.
Found him nosing about, thought we should bring him along.
Why, Iskrimnor rumbled, he doesn't look like anything but a scavenger.
Einskaldir shrugged. Fairhead Sludig, his companion, grinned affably. It hadn't been his idea.
No houses around. We saw no boy at the abbey. Where did he come from?
Einskaldir cut loose another piece with his knife.
When we grabbed him, he yelled for someone. Bena or Binok? Couldn't say for sure.
Iskrimnor turned away to briefly survey Hover's body, now laid out on a cloak. He was kin, the cousin of his son Isorn's wife. Not close kin, but close enough by the customs of the cold north that Iskrimnor felt a deep pang of remorse as he stared down at the young man's snow-pale face, at his thin yellow beard. From there he turned to the captive, still bound at the wrists, but lowered from the horse to lie propped against a rock. The boy was only a year or two younger than Hover, thin but wiry, and the sight of his freckled face and shock of reddish hair tugged at Iskrimnor's memory. He could not summon the reminder forth. The youth was still stunned from the tap Einskaldir had given him, eyes closed and mouth slack.
Looks like any poor peasant lout, the Duke thought, except for those boots, which I'll wager he found at the abbey. Why, in the name of Memor's fountain, did Einskaldir bring him? What am I supposed to do with him? Kill him? Keep him? Leave him to starve? Let's get to finding rocks, the Duke said at last. Hover will need a cairn. This looks like wolf country to me.
Night had come down. The outcroppings of rock that dotted the desolate plain below Wealdhelm were only clumps of deeper shadow. The fire had been stoked high, and the men were listening to Sludig sing a bawdy song. Iskrimnor knew only too well why men who had been blooded, who had lost one of their own. Hover's undistinguished pile of stones was one of the shadow clumps out beyond the firelight. Might feel the urge to indulge in such foolishness. As he himself had said months ago, standing across the table from King Elias, there were frightening rumors on the wind. Here on the open plain, dwarfed but not protected by the looming hills, things that would travel as tales in the Hayholt or Elvrit's Harler, ghost fables to enliven a dull evening, were no longer so easy to brush aside with a laughing remark. So the men sang, and their voices made an off-key but very human sound in the night wilderness.
And ghost tales aside, Iskrimnor thought, we were attacked today, and for no reason I can fathom. They were waiting for us, waiting. What in the name of sweet Usiris does that mean?
It could have been that the brigands were merely waiting for the next group of travelers who might stop at the abbey. But why? If they were only after robbing and whatnot, why not pillage the abbey itself, a place likely to have at least a fine reliquary or two? And why wait for chance travelers at an abbey in the first place, where there would naturally be witnesses to any act of thievery?
Not that we've got many witnesses left, damn their eyes. One, maybe, if that boy proves to have seen anything.
It just did not make good sense. Waiting to waylay a company of travelers, who even in these times might prove to be king's guardsmen, who had in fact turned out to be armed, battle-honed northerners. So the possibility had to be entertained that he and his men had been the targets. Why? And just as importantly, who? Iskrimnor's enemies, Skarli of Kaldskrika, being a prime example, were well known to him, and none of the bandits had been recognized as members of Skarli's clan. Besides, Skarli was gone back to Kaldskrika long ago. And how could he have known that his Grimnor, sick to death of inactivity and fearing for the safety of his duchy, would decide at last to confront Elias and, after an argument, receive his reluctant royal permission to take his men north? "We need you here, uncle," he told me. He knew I had stopped believing that long ago. Just wanted to keep his eye on me. That's what I think. Still, Elias had not resisted anywhere near as strongly as the Duke had anticipated. The argument had seemed to Isgrimnor only a matter of form, as though Elias had known the confrontation was coming and had decided to accede already. Frustrated by the circles his thoughts were following, Isgrimnor was about to lever himself up and off to his bedroll when Freka came to him, the fire at the aged soldier's back making him a gaunt, shambling shadow.
"A moment, your lordship."
Isgrimnor suppressed a grin. The old bastard must be drunk. He only got formal when he was in his cups.
"Freka?" "It's that boy, sire. The one Einskelde brought back. He's awake. Thought your lordship might like to chat with him."
He swayed a little, but quickly turned it into a gesture of pulling up his breeches.
"Well, I suppose."
The breeze was up. Isgrimnor pulled his kirtle tighter and started to turn, then stopped.
"Freka?"
"Lordship?"
"I threw another damned carving in the fire."
"I expected you would, sire."
As Freka wheeled around to head back to the beer jug, Isgrimnor was positive the old man wore a tiny smile. Well, damn him and his wood, anyway. The boy was sitting up, chewing the meat from a bone. Einskaldir sat on a rock beside him, looking deceptively relaxed. Isgrimnor had never seen the man relax. The firelight could not reach Einskaldir's deep-set stare. But the boy, when he looked up, was as wide-eyed as a deer surprised at a forest pond. At the Duke's approach, the boy stopped chewing and regarded Isgrimnor suspiciously for a moment, mouth half open. But then, even by fireglow, Isgrimnor saw something pass across the boy's face. Was it relief? Isgrimnor was troubled. He had expected, despite Einskaldir's suspicions, the man after all was as prickly with mistrust as a hedgehog. To find a frightened peasant boy, terrified or at least dully apprehensive. This one looked like a peasant, an ignorant cotsman's son in tattered clothes, covered in dirt. But there was a certain alertness to his gaze that made the Duke wonder if perhaps Einskaldir hadn't been right.
"Here now, boy," he said gruffly in the Westerling speech. "What were you doing poking about the abbey?"
"I think I'm going to slit his throat now," Einskaldir said in Rimmerspec,
pleasant tone in horrid contrast to his words. Isgrimnor scowled, wondering if the man had lost his mind, then realized as the boy continued to stare blandly up at him that Einskaldir was only probing to find if the boy spoke their tongue.
"Well, if he does, he's one of the coolest wits I've ever seen," Isgrimnor thought.
No, it beggared imagination to think a boy this age, in the camp of armed strangers, could have understood Einskaldir's chilling words and not reacted at all.
"He doesn't understand,"
the Duke said to his liegemen in their Rimmersgaard tongue.
"But he is a calm one, isn't he?"
Einskaldir grunted an affirmative and scratched his chin through his dark beard.
"Now, boy," the Duke resumed, "I asked you once, speak, what brought you to the abbey?"
The youth lowered his eyes and set the bone he had been gnawing on the ground. Isgrimnor again felt a tug at his memory, but still could summon nothing.
I was looking for some new shoes to wear."
The boy gestured to his clean, well-cared-for boots. The Duke picked him out by his accent as an Erkinlander, and something more. But what?
"And you found some, I see."
The Duke squatted so that he was at eye level.
"Do you know you can be hanged for stealing from the unburied dead?"
Finally, a satisfying reaction. The boy's heartfelt flinch at the threat could not have been studied, Iskrimnor felt sure. Good.
I'm sorry, Master. I didn't mean any harm. I was hungry from walking, and my feet hurt.
Walking from where?
He had it now. The boy spoke too well to be a woodsman's brat. He was a priest's boy, or a shopkeeper's son, or some such. He'd run away, no doubt. The youth held his Grimnor's stare for a moment. Again the Duke had the feeling the boy was calculating. A runaway from a seminary, perhaps, or a monastery. What was he hiding? The boy spoke at last.
I have left my master, sir. My parents. My parents apprenticed me to a chandler. He beat me.
What chandler? Where? Quickly!
Malachias. In Urchester.
It makes sense, mostly, the Duke decided, except for two details. What are you doing here, then? What brought you to St. Hodoran's? And who, Iskrimnor lanced in now, is Banner?
Banner?
And Skaldir, who had been listening with half-closed eyes, leaned forward.
He knows, Duke, he said in Rimmersbach. He said Banner or Binnock, that's sure. How about Binnock, then?
Iskrimnor dropped a wide hand on the captive's shoulder and felt only a twinge of regret when the boy winced.
Binnock? Oh, Binnock's... my dog, sir. Master's, actually. He ran away, too.
And the boy actually smiled, a lopsided grin that he quickly suppressed. Despite his misgivings, the old Duke found himself liking the lad.
I'm heading for Naglamund, sir, the boy continued quickly. I heard the abbey fed travellers like me. When I saw the bodies, the dead men, I was scared. But I needed some boots, sir. I truly did. Those monks were good Aedonites, sir. They wouldn't have minded, would they?
Naglamund?
The Duke's eyes narrowed, and he sensed Einskaldir grow a little more taut, if such a thing was possible at the boy's side.
Why Naglamund? Why not Stanshire or Hasu Vale?
I have a friend there.
Behind Iskrimnor, Sludig's voice rose, careening through a final drunken chorus. The boy made a gesture in the direction of the fire circle.
He's a harper, sir. He told me if I ran away from Malachias to come to him and he would help me.
A harper? At Naglamund?
Iskrimnor stared intently. But the boy's face, though shadowed, was as innocent as cream. Iskrimnor suddenly felt disgusted with the whole business.
Look at me, questioning a chandler's boy, as if he had single-handedly led the ambush at the abbey. What a damnable day it has been.
Einskaldi was still not satisfied. He bent his face close to the boy's ear and asked, in his heavily accented speech,
What is the Naglamund harper's name?
The youth turned, alarmed, but seemingly from the sudden proximity of Einskaldir rather than the question. For a moment later, he blithely responded,
Sangfugl.
Freyja's paps,
Iskrimnor cursed and climbed heavily to his feet.
I know him. That's enough. I believe you, boy.
Einskaldir had turned away, pivoting on his rocky seat to watch the men laughing and arguing at the fire.
You may stay with us, boy, if you like, the Duke said. We will be stopping at Naglamund, and thanks to those whoreson bastards, we have Hover's horse going riderless. This is hard country for a stripling to cross alone. And these days, it's near as much as slitting your own throat to travel out of company. Here.
He walked to one of the horses and pulled a saddle blanket down, tossing it to the youth.
Bed down wherever you like, as long as it's close in. Easier for the man standing sentry if we're not strung out like a flock of straying sheep.
He stared at the thistledown hair starting out in all directions, and the bright eyes.
Ein skald ye fed you. Do you need aught?
The boy blinked. Where had he seen him? In the town, probably. No, the boy replied. I was just hoping that Binnock would not get lost without me.
Trust me, boy. If he doesn't find you, he'll find someone else, and that's a fact.
Einskaldi had already slipped away. His Grimnor stumped off. The boy curled himself in the blanket and lay down at the foot of the rock. I haven't really seen the stars for a while, Simon thought, as he stared up from his blanket. The bright points seemed to hang like frozen fireflies. It's just not the same looking up through the trees as it is out here in the open. Like being on a tabletop. He thought of Seta's blanket, and doing so thought of Binnabik. I hope he's safe. Then again, it was him who left me to the Rimmer's men. It had been a stroke of luck that his captor had turned out to be Dukas Grimnor, but still there had been moments of real terror, waking up in the camp surrounded by hard-looking, bearded men. He supposed that knowing the ill will between Binnabik's people and the Rimmer's men, he did not really hold it against the Troll for having disappeared, if he had even known of Simon's abduction. Still, it hurt to lose a friend that way. He would have to harden himself. He had begun to depend on the little man to know what was right, what had to be done, just as he had once listened raptly to Dr. Morgani's. Well, the lesson was clear. He would be his own man, keep his own counsel, and make his way. In truth, he had not wanted to tell Iskrimnor his true destination, but the Duke was sharp, and Simon had felt several times that the old soldier was balancing him on the blade of a knife. One false step would have tipped him over. Besides, that dark one who sat beside me all the time, he looked like he would kill me, just like drowning a kitten if it suited him. So, he had given the Duke all the truth he comfortably could, and it had worked. The question then was what to do now. Should he stay with the Rimmer's men? It would seem foolish not to, but still. Simon was not yet totally sure of where the Duke stood. Iskrimnor was going to Naglimund, but what if it was to arrest Joshua? Everybody at the Hayholt was forever talking about how loyal Iskrimnor had been to old King John, how he held the High King's ward more sacred than his own life. Where did he fit in with Elias? Under no circumstances did Simon intend to tell what part he had played in Joshua's departure from the Hayholt, but things had a way of slipping out sometimes. Simon was dying to hear some news of the castle, of what had happened after Morgani's last gambit. Had Priorates lived? Inch? What had Elias told the people had happened? But it was exactly those kind of questions, no matter how guilefully asked, that could drop him into boiling water. He was too wound up to sleep. As he stared up at the scattered stars, he thought of the bones he had seen Binnabik cast that morning. The wind brushed his face, and suddenly the stars themselves were bones, a wild array strewn across the dark field of the sky. It was lonely out here among strangers, under the limitless night. He longed for his homely bed in the servants' quarters, for the days when none of these things had happened. His longing was like the piercing music of Binnabik's flute, a cool pain that was nevertheless the only thing he could cling to in the wide, wild world. He had dozed a little, but when the noise awakened him, heart thumping, the stars still burned deep in the blackness. A momentary panic constricted his throat as a dark shape loomed over him, impossibly tall. Where was the moon? It was only the man on watch, he saw an instant later, stopping for a moment with his back to Simon's blanket. The sentry had his own saddle blanket, and had wrapped it high on his shoulders, the dome of his unhelmeted head poking up through the folds. The watchman wandered past without looking down. He had an axe tucked in his broad belt, a wickedly sharp, heavy weapon. He also carried a spear, longer than he was tall. As he paced, the butt end dragged in the dirt. Simon pulled the blanket closer, huddling himself against the sharp wind that was moving across the plain. The sky had changed. Where before it had been clear, the stars picked out in brilliant detail against its unfathomable blackness. Now it was sullied by streamers of clouds, milky tendrils reaching out like fingers from the north. At the far side of the sky, they had covered the lowest stars, like sand poured over the coals of a fire.
Maybe Seda will catch her husband tonight, Simon thought sleepily.
The second time he awoke, it was to a splash of water in his eyes and nose. He opened his eyes, gasping, to see the stars had been snuffed above him, as neatly as a top closing on a jewel chest. It was raining, the clouds now directly overhead. Simon grunted, wiping water from his face, and turned on his side, pulling the blanket up to make a hood for his head. He could see the sentry again, a little farther away now, shielding his face and staring up into the rain. Simon's eyes were just drifting closed when the man made an odd grunting noise and dropped his head to look down. Something in the man's stance, something that suggested that though he stood rock still, he was nevertheless struggling, made Simon open his eyes wider. The rain began to sheet down, and thunder growled distantly. Simon strained to see the sentry through the boiling downpour. The man was still standing in the same place, but something was moving now at his feet, something active that had pulled free from the general blackness. Simon sat up, and the raindrops pounded and splashed on the ground all about. A flash of lightning abruptly lit the night, making the rocks glare forth like painted wooden props from an Usiri's play. Everything in the camp came clear, the steaming remains of the fire, the huddled sleeping forms of the Rimmer's men. But what leaped to Simon's eye in that split instant was the sentry, whose face was stretched in a hideous, silent mask of absolute terror. Thunder crashed, and then the sky was smeared with lightning again. The ground around the sentry was seething, gouting up in great sprays of dirt. Simon's heart lurched in his breast as the man fell to his knees. The thunder cannoned again. Lightning flared three times in succession. The earth continued to fountain up, but now there were hands everywhere, and long, thin arms glinting slickly in the rain as they crawled up the body of the kneeling man, pulling him down, face forward into the black soil. The sky glare caught a greater surge of movement, as a horde of dark things pushed up from the earth, thin, ragged things with waving arms, staring white eyes, and horribly revealed as the lightning leaped across the sky and the rain hissed down, matted whiskers and tattered clothes. As the thunder died out, Simon shouted, choking on water, then shouted again. It was worse than any vision of hell. The Rimmer's men, startled awake by Simon's terrified cry, were beset from all sides by hopping, flailing bodies. The things were boiling up from the ground like rats. Indeed, as they scrambled through the camp, the night was filled with thin, mewling squeals that rang of tunnels and blindness and cowardly malice. One of the northerners was on his feet, the creatures swarming over him. They were none of them as tall as Binnabik, but their numbers were prodigious, and even as the northerner unsheathed his sword, they pulled him down. Simon thought he saw the flash of sharp things in their hands, rising and falling.
"Fire! Vauerbrücken!" one of the Rimmer's men shouted from the other side of the camp.
The men were up now, and in the intermittent flashes Simon could see the pale fire of their swords and axes. Kicking away the blanket, he climbed to his feet, searching desperately for a weapon. The things were everywhere, prancing on their thin legs like insects, calling out, shrieking thinly when the axe of a Rimmer's man bit. Their cries almost sounded like a language, and that, in the midst of nightmare, was one of the most horrible things of all. Simon ducked behind the rock that had sheltered him, circling around as he looked frantically for something to protect himself with. A figure hurtled toward him, tumbling to the ground only a pace away. One of the northerners, half of his face a wet ruin. Simon bolted forward to pull the axe from his convulsive grasp. Not yet dead, the man gurgled as Simon dragged the weapon free. A moment later, Simon felt a bony clutch at his knee and whirled to see a hideous little man-like face behind the grasping claw, eyes staring whitely. He swung the axe down at the face as hard as he could and felt a crunch like a beetle ground underfoot. The stiff fingers fell away, and Simon leaped free, gagging. With the light from the sky alternately blooming and dying, it was nearly impossible to tell what was happening. The swaying figures of the Rimmer's men stood all around, but there was a far greater number of hopping, piping demons. It seemed that the best place to... Simon was knocked to the ground without warning, a gripping paw around his neck. He felt the side of his face go down into the mud, tasted it, then heaved up against the thing on his back. A crude blade whickered past his eyes and stuck with a sucking noise in the earth. Simon clambered to his knees, but another hand reached around his face, covering his eyes. It stank of mud and foul water, the fingers squirming like night crawlers. "Where is the axe? I've dropped the axe!" He clambered shakily to his feet, legs wide on the slippery ground, and tried to pry loose the clamping fingers around his windpipe. He stumbled forward, nearly falling again, unable to dislodge the awful, strangling thing from his back. The bony hand was cutting off his air, the sharp knees digging at his ribs. He thought he heard the ropey thing squealing in triumph. He managed a few more steps before he dropped to his knees, the din of battle growing fainter behind him. His ears roared, strength flowed out of his arms and body like meal from a torn sack. "I'm dying," was all he could think. Before his eyes there was nothing but dull red light. Then the crushing, scratching grip on his throat was suddenly gone. Simon fell heavily on his chest and face and lay gasping. Wheezing, he looked up. Painted against the black sky by a sheet of crackling lightning was a mad silhouette. A man on a wolf. "Binnipeg!" Sucking air into his ragged throat, Simon tried to pull himself upright, but could get no farther than his elbows before the little man was at his side. A pace away, the body of the earth creature lay curled like a singed spider, blind eyes to the sky.
"Say nothing," Binnipeg hissed. "We must go, quickly."
He helped Simon to a sitting position, but the boy waved him away, batting at the little man with baby-weak hands.
Have to.
Simon wagged a shaking hand toward the chaos that raged around the campsite, some 20 paces away.
"Ridiculous," Binnipeg snapped. "The Rimmer's men can fight their own battles. My duty is to get you to safety. Now come."
"No,"
Simon said stubbornly. Binnipeg held his hollowed stick in his hand. Simon knew what had felled his attacker.
We have to help them.
"They will survive."
Binnipeg was grim. Kantaka had followed her master and now sniffed solicitously at Simon's wound.
"You are my charge."
"What do you..."
Simon began. Kantaka growled, a deep threatening sound of alarm. Binnipeg looked up.
"Daughter of the mountains,"
he groaned. Simon followed his gaze. A clot of the greater darkness had broken off from the swirling melee and was rapidly moving toward them. It was hard to tell how many creatures might be in the bounding tangle of arms and eyes, but it was more than a few.
"Nehot Kantaka,"
Binnipeg shouted. An instant later, the wolf sprang toward them. They squealed in whistling terror as she struck.
"We have no more time to waste, Simon,"
the troll snapped. Thunder caromed across the plain as he pulled his knife from his belt and dragged Simon up.
"The Duke's men are holding their own now, and I have no way to afford your being killed in the last struggling."
In the midst of the earth burrowers, Kantaka was a gray-furred engine of death. As her great jaws bit, and she shook and bit again, thin black bodies hurtled away on all sides to fall in broken heaps. More were swarming over. and the wolf's buzzing snarl rose above the storm's rumble.
But...
Simon held back as Binnebik moved toward his mount.
It was my pan promise to protect you,
Binnebik said, tugging Simon along.
That was Dr. Morgani's wish.
Doctor... You? No Dr. Morgani's?
As Simon stared, mouth working, Binnebik stopped and whistled twice. Kantaka, with a last ecstatic shiver, flung two of the creatures aside and bounded toward them.
Now run, foolish boy!
Binnebik shouted. They ran, Kantaka first, leaping like a hart, her muzzle black with blood, Binnebik after. Simon followed, tripping and staggering across the muddy plain as the storm shouted unanswerable questions. Chapter 22. A Wind from the North.
No, I don't want a damned thing.
Guthwulf, Earl of Utanyit, spat citral juice on the tile floor as the wide-eyed page went scurrying away. Watching him go, Guthwulf regretted his hasty words, not out of any sympathy for the boy, but because he had suddenly realized that he might indeed want something. He had been nearly an hour waiting outside the throne room, without a drop of anything to drink, and only Aiden himself knew how much longer he might sit here, rotting. He spat again, the pungent citral stinging his tongue and lips, and cursed as he wiped a line of spittle off his long jaw. Unlike many of the men in his command, Guthwulf was not accustomed to having a piece of the bitter southern root always tucked in his cheek. But during this strange damp spring, one that had found him confined for days at a time in the hayholt, waiting on the king's bidding, he had found that any distraction, even that of burning one's palate, was welcome. Also, and undoubtedly because of the wet weather, the halls of the hayholt seemed to reek of mould.